Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Her mother was a connoisseur of classical music, so Angelina Rice named her daughter Condoleezza, Italian for with sweetness. But she raised her black daughter in the racially violent South to be tough, and that tough young girl is now the no-nonsense national security advisor to President George W. Bush. Condi Rice has the president's time, his trust, and his ear like nobody else. This hour, we're talking about Condoleezza Rice, foreign policy point woman in the Bush War Cabinet. We begin tonight in Washington, where a hot-button issue is playing out on Capitol Hill, the Enron debacle. Former Enron CEO Jeffrey Skilling appeared today before a congressional committee. NPR's Emily Harris was there. Earlier, I asked her what Mr. Skilling had to say for himself.
He was very defiant. He was really basically came out and said that he did nothing wrong. He was very, very proud of Enron and all the work that they were doing. When he left last August, he repeated this several times. When I left August 14th, I had no idea the company was facing any imminent financial problems. And he basically said that he thought that there were controls in place. He thought the controls were being followed. And he basically laid out a version of events at Enron that's quite different than what we've heard so far.
And yet, within weeks of the time of his resignation, the company was gigantically beginning to unravel. Did the congressional members buy his posture?
They did not, actually. They were very skeptical of what he said. And you're right, within weeks of his departure, things started to unravel publicly at Enron. One congressman pointed out that within a day, in fact, of Skilling's departure, a lower-level employee, Sharon Watkins, wrote a memo anonymously at first and to Ken Lay, the founder, and at that point he had come back on as CEO, outlining her concerns with these off-the-book partnerships. She said she thought the whole company could come down. And one congressman, Ed Markey, said, you know, if she knew about this, she's a VP, you're the CEO, Mr. Skilling, she knew about this, why didn't you? So basically they were very, very doubtful of his version of events.
So how did he pursue that line that everything was fine, given the evidence of Enron's collapse?
Well, he basically said a number of things. One, he said that these types of off-book partnerships are widely used in corporate America for very good reasons, that they shift risk from a company to investors that have greater tolerance for risk and want the kind of returns that risk provide. He said that there were controls in place for the way these particular partnerships were being set up, and he thought that those controls were being followed. There's a dispute about whether or not he actually had to sign off on some of these deals. His signature doesn't appear on some sheets, and that actually came down to a dispute about whether he was at a board meeting in Florida where supposedly he was given or accepted the responsibility for signing off on these deals, and he said he didn't remember agreeing to take that responsibility, and in fact, there was some trouble with the power there. The lights went off. People were in and out of the room. So Congressman felt that was a pretty dubious story.
Was he saying that things went wrong, but it wasn't his fault that he wasn't aware? He's been called the ultimate control freak as a manager. Was he denying that he knew what actually happened or saying he knew, but he thought it was fine?
Well, he said that he has not yet seen, to this day, seen any evidence that the partnerships were set up to hide debt or to boost profits.
Which is to say, if he doesn't know now, he didn't know then.
He didn't know then and doesn't believe that there's any evidence that those partnerships were set up that way. He says there were controls in place, and he didn't know about it.
He told the committee, he said, I did not believe the company was in any financial peril. Did something change that couldn't have been anticipated, or was he just deaf, dumb, and blind as a CEO?
Well, it's differing versions. I mean, that's basically the problem. For example, he remembers a conversation where another executive brought up his concerns about the way these partnerships were structured. He remembers that conversation differently. It comes down to several versions of many different complicated events, and It's still not entirely clear. Much more was laid out at this hearing than we'd heard before, because we hadn't heard from Jeff Skilling before. We hadn't heard publicly from the other executives at Enron that testified. But there's still stuff that is unanswered. Most specifically, the Congress has not yet heard from Andrew Fastow, who is allegedly the man who both structured these partnerships and personally benefited from their setup.
And took the fifth today.
He took the fifth today.
Jeffrey Skilling was famously nicknamed Darth Vader at Enron and was reportedly proud of that nickname. What was his demeanor with the Congressional Committee today?
He had not come across as the man who also swore at analysts at a conference call last spring. I mean, he came off as very proud. He came off as truly defiant in terms of contradicting the version of the events that many of the members of the committee seem to believe about what happened at Enron. But he also said he was under a great deal of pressure. He said he felt basically terrible that things turned out the way they did. He called Cliff Baxter his best friend, and Cliff Baxter, as you may remember, was a former Enron executive who killed himself.
Shot himself in Houston not long ago.
That's right.
Representative Bobby Rush said today, was selling your morals worth it? It sounds as though ex-CEO Jeffrey Skilling denying that he sold any morals, denying that he did anything wrong at all.
That's essentially right. Yes, he does not believe he did anything wrong.
And the response from the committee, does it lead you to believe that they're satisfied with that answer or that there will be more to come?
Oh, no. This committee is not done with Enron. This committee, I don't know if they'll call Jeff Skilling back, but they certainly reserve the right to do that. And he said he's cooperating, and he was not subpoenaed to appear, and he expressed willingness to continue to talk to them. But this committee is not done with Enron. The multiple other committees that are investigating Enron are not done either. There's a lot of this story that has yet to unfold.
NPR's Emily Harris spoke to us from Washington. At 46, Condi Rice is one of the youngest people ever to serve as National Security Advisor. She's also the first woman and first African-American woman at that. But friends will tell you that what matters is her brilliant mind and famously steely determination, both of which were molded to a high pitch by her proud black parents. John and Angelina Rice didn't want life in segregated Birmingham, Alabama, to hold their children down. If you want to get something done, her father said, do it right and do it yourself. Today, Condoleezza Rice has brought that unbending spirit to the White House. Who is Condi Rice? How do her personal history and her politics play out in the Bush view of terror and the world? And what do you think of her steely view of foreign policy? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Judith Kipper. She's director of the Middle East Forum at the Council on Foreign Relations and co-director of the Middle East Studies Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. A special welcome to you, Judith Kipper. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Judith Kipper, help us understand this woman who has President Bush's ear so constantly and intimately on all matters of national security and foreign policy. How do you see Condoleezza Rice's personal history playing out in her contemporary politics and advice to the president?
I think that Condoleezza Rice is, no matter how you measure it, a really extraordinary person. She is obviously brilliant and extremely talented. She graduated from college at a very early age, went on into a very, very difficult field in her studies. She achieved a lot academically and professionally very early. She is a concert pianist. Very well organized, has 10-minute meetings, absorbs things very quickly. So in whatever she does, she is obviously somebody who's been programmed to succeed and is a high achiever and will do well in whatever job she has. I think as in her role with the president, she enjoys his trust. And she is also someone that he is prepared to spend a lot of time with, which is absolutely necessary for any national security advisor, particularly at a time of crisis. So this very close friendship and professional relationship that she has with the president, which existed apparently long before he was elected, I think serves the presidency very well and the nation.
Judith Kipper, take us into that a little bit, if you can. We'll get to policy, but on this personality front, chemistry is important. How do you explain the meeting of these two personalities, young black woman and George W. Bush? What is it about their individual personalities that apparently creates such an easy and tight, trusting chemistry?
I suspect that both are very much down to earth, that they have a high respect for each other, they like each other, and that they have complementary needs. Clearly, she is someone who is filled with knowledge, analysis, an academic background, and he is a president who has very, very limited foreign policy experience, hasn't traveled much outside the country before he became president, and whatever basis brought them together for friendship has obviously worked very well in developing a critical professional relationship.
How do you see Condoleezza Rice's imprint visible on the pre- and post-September 11th foreign policy, national security policy of the Bush administration? Judith Kipper.
I think it's very difficult to see a direct imprint. This administration has been particularly good at preventing leaks and getting into personality politics in the foreign policy field. Before September 11th, there were some rumors here and there about the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense, but none of it really panned out, and it disappeared very quickly. I think what we can do if we step back is look at September 11th up to now, that the administration has handled it with a great deal of skill and sensitivity. And obviously, before the president makes a decision, most of the time she is probably the last person that he talks to. Her job is to bring together for him all of the options that may be available and probably give him the benefit of her opinion, her analysis of which option best serves the purpose at any given moment. So I think we see her impact when we look at how the president himself has done in the field of foreign policy, because she, after all, is his closest aide on foreign policy and has served the role of being his tutor on foreign issues.
And famously adept at distilling issues for the president so that the choices, I guess, are relatively clear. As you say, there has been a quite remarkable united front in this administration. Still, there's talk and speculation about tension lines within the foreign policy. Does Colin Powell want to lean more this direction or Donald Rumsfeld that? How do you see the tension lines in the Bush administration's foreign policy? Can you lift the covers for us a little bit? What are the tensions there?
Before September 11th, this administration was on an isolationist path, no nation building. We're the big guy, the strong guy. We will do it our way, and so on. But after all, that was a little bit left over from the campaign. Mm-hmm. September 11th happened into the first year, only 9 months into the first year of the presidency, not even 9 months. So I think that early ideological isolationist view of the world was really left over from campaign rhetoric. When September 11th happened, clearly they had to go into a different mode of taking action, of leading the nation, of calming fears and assessing threats. And I think they've done that very well. If you look at the kinds of people that have been appointed to the State Department and to the Pentagon, there is a clear ideological difference between them. The Pentagon tends to have officials who are better known for being on the right, for being extremely conservative, for supporting military action. Those at the State Department under Colin Powell, I think, are people who are looking at analysis, at diplomatic options, at ways to solve things without using the military instrument. It is the nature of the two departments, obviously, Department of Defense, Department of State. But I think among the people, there are some real differences, and this is built in every single administration.
We're going to be looking at Condoleezza Rice's personality and role in sorting out those tensions in this administration, the Bush administration. We're joined by Judith Kipper. She's director of the Middle East Forum at the Council on Foreign Relations. And we're looking at the first female, first African-American, and very young, relatively to her predecessors, National Security Advisor to George Bush, the woman who has the president's ear on foreign policy. You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. What do you think? What is the Condi Rice view of the world? Join us at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about Condoleezza Rice, National Security Advisor and trusted intimate to President George W. Bush. In 1976, a very young Condi Rice voted for Jimmy Carter, but switched sides after she saw how Carter handled the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Speaking at the Republican National Convention in 2000, Condoleezza Rice described why she became a member of the GOP.
For different reasons. I found a party that sees me as an individual, not as part of a group. I found a party that puts family first. I found a party that has love of liberty at its core, and I found a party that believes that peace begins with strength.
That was Condoleezza Rice speaking at the 2000 Republican National Convention. What do you think? What is the Condi Rice view of the world? Is the tough, proud childhood in violently segregated Alabama of Condoleezza Rice now the animating spirit of American foreign policy? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined by Judith Kipper, director of the Middle East Forum at the Council on Foreign Relations, and by our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. Jack, what do you see in this remarkable picture of a national security advisor to George W. Bush?
Well, as you say, it is a remarkable picture. There's a wonderful portrait of her in the Washington Post magazine that I recommend to anybody who's moved by this story, and you can't not be and be an American. She actually was in church when the bombs went off at the 16th Street Baptist Church. She talked about terrorism. It was right there in her life. She knew one of the little girls who was killed in that bombing. She showed through her family how dignity could and personal determination could triumph over a system of racism and insult. And her self-control and poise and drive and so on is all that is heartening. The thing I'm most heartened about her, though, is I looked a little bit into her scholarly work. There isn't a heck of a lot of it, but she's written mostly about Eastern Europe and about the end of the Cold War in Eastern Europe. And, you know, my hope is that she looks at that as a metaphor, that episode in American history is about the success of a policy called containment. We contained the evil of Soviet communism, and it fell of its own contradictions. To be sure, we put pressure on it in various ways, but we never went to war. Mm. But it seems to me if we could contain Soviet communism, we can contain Saddam Hussein and Iran and North Korea, and that the sort of unilateralist will strike first talk of the president, that's not part of the metaphor of containment. And I hope that she sort of keeps that great, that historic policy success before her as she's trying to be an honest broker between defense and state.
And yet the aggressive language that President Bush has used most recently in the State of the Union speech doesn't exactly sound like a containment policy. Judith Kipper, Jack Beatty, stand by. We're joined now by Evan Thomas. He's assistant managing editor for Newsweek magazine. Recently co-authored a Newsweek article titled Chemistry in the War Cabinet. Good evening and welcome, Evan Thomas.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Evan Thomas, what's the rep on Condi Rice in Washington these days? Is she suggesting containment in the war on terrorism or something more aggressive?
I think something more aggressive. The tilt here, clearly the president's tilt, is preemptive. I mean, he wants to, if you believe his rhetoric, go to war here, not right away, not just right off the bat, but the phrase du jour is regime change.
Mm-hmm.
And
that implies big intervention.
From everything I've heard, Bush means it.
Mm-hmm. And looking at Condoleezza Rice, she's the final filter, the last word on these issues. Is that her view that's being expressed in this policy, or can you tell?
A little bit hard to tell. She's been characterized to me by people who know is that in the Rumsfeld Cheney axis versus Powell, she's about 60-40 on the Rumsfeld Cheney side.
Mm-hmm. And what about the famous chemistry between Rice and Bush? How do you account for that, Evan Thomas?
Well, it's genuine. They spend a lot of time together. I mean, sort of sounds trite, but they talk sports. They talk football. She, you know, this is a woman who wants to be head of the NFL and used to go to Stanford football practices and work out with the team. And she is good at that locker room stuff. I mean, she takes it all in stride. You know, it's a very teasing kind of macho, almost a throwback group of the 50s, a bunch of macho males hanging around the locker room. And she takes all that in stride. They tease her, and she teases them right back.
We're impressed by the portrait of her drawn in the Washington Post magazine recently, the stories of her upbringing in very segregated Birmingham, Alabama, and the proud lessons of have a lot of backbone, girl, that her parents gave her there. Do you see that toughness, even that brush with terror, she saw violence in the segregated South, informing Condoleezza Rice's view of the world now, maybe the Bush administration's stiff spine toward the world now, Evan Thomas?
Yes. I mean, you can use a stiff spine in lots of different ways. You can use a stiff spine to not go to war as well as to go to war.
Yes, of course.
You cannot possibly underestimate the impact of her childhood. She talks about it. It's obvious that very proud black elite and segregated Birmingham. Colin Powell appreciates this, interestingly, because his wife Alma is from that same world. Hmm. And it's a special, or was a special world. And one of Connie Rice's favorite stories is the time that she went to buy some clothes with her mother, and the clerk at it was one of the nice stores, or quote nice stores in Birmingham, and the clerk tried to sell him the cheap stuff, and Condi's mother said, no.
No way, no how.
No way, no how. And that, I mean, that's the way Condi is. Condi Rice is a very proud person and a tough-minded person, and she has this kind of almost bland exterior in some ways, but beneath it is real steel.
Well, we see her photographed now by Annie Leibovitz in Vogue magazine, looking very elegant indeed. Judith Kipper is on with us and said earlier, Evan Thomas, that she sees a softening in the kind of unilateral hardbar approach that was central to the campaign language of the Bush campaign around foreign policy. Do you agree? Do you see a new suppleness?
No. I think they're as unilateralist as ever. In fact, if anything, more so, because I think Bush is personally emboldened by what happened. I mean, I think the difference is in the campaign they were kind of not so much isolationist. This is unilateralist, is isolationist. It was, you know, let's go home. I think now it's an assertion of American power. But it's yes, if our allies will come with us, that's great. But if they won't, that's too bad. We're going anyway.
And Condoleezza Rice's fingerprints on that?
More as an executor than as an advisor. I mean, she does try to play this role of honest broker, and she is reflecting the president's view. I think, as you know, we said, she's somewhere in between Powell and Rumsfeld ideologically, but I don't think her ideology is all that strong. I think she really wants to be the classic role of national security advisor who is
making it work.
Making it work, yeah.
Evan Thomas is assistant managing editor for Newsweek magazine. Evan Thomas, thanks very much for joining us.
You bet.
Judith Kipper, Evan Thomas isn't buying the new suppleness characterization. Where do you see the transformation, the change in the administration in Condi Rice since 9/11?
I'm not sure it's suppleness that I was referring to. I think it's necessity.
Mm-hmm.
The threats to the United States today are transnational. Sovereignty, though we are the only superpower and can project power in many, many different ways, nevertheless, the problems that face us, be they terrorism, the spread of weapons of mass destruction, AIDS, safe seas, airports, etc., around the world, none of those issues can be dealt with by a superpower alone. We can certainly provide the leadership, which the administration has done, but it requires a multilateral approach. It means that we have to cooperate with some countries that are even part of the problem. And I think that that forces them out of the isolationist mode. If they could, surely mm-hmm. they would handle the Al-Qaeda network, the Taliban, and other terrorist organizations only with the United States. But it's not possible. We have to share intelligence. We have financial institutions that are very important that other countries have to confront. Various groups, arrests, and so on. So we cannot be the world's policemen. And after September 11th, I think it became clear to the president and his foreign policy team that success in the war on terrorism is going to depend on the kind of cooperation we can encourage from friends, allies, and even from those with which we may have strained relations.
Mm-hmm. And still, you get the feeling that if necessary, this is a White House that will, if it believes it must, go it alone. Judith Kipper, Jack Beatty, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join us. Let's turn to them. Jeff is on the line. Welcome, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
We're well, thanks.
Good. I didn't vote for Bush or anything like that, and I'm not really sure about the ideological thing, but I just wanted to say something. I read an article about her, and she changed my mind. On gun control, I've always been for it.
Yeah.
And I'm not really sure how much I differ now, but it made a difference in the way I think about it.
What was her argument or her personal history that changed your mind?
Well, when she was a child and that church was blown up.
16th Street Church in Birmingham, Alabama?
Correct. The parents, and her father being one of them on the block, got their guns, and they sort of cordoned off the neighborhood to help keep it safe.
Mm-hmm.
She said that if the sheriff of that town had been able to keep people from buying guns, he certainly would have kept the blacks in that town from buying guns, and she's not so sure how safe her neighborhood would have been, and that just blew my mind. I never thought of it that way.
So there's Condi Rice reaching out to touch you, maybe a liberal or at least a Democrat, Jeff, and turning your mind around on gun control. Jeff, thanks for the call. Jack Beatty, there you hear the persuasive power of stories rooted in tough reality in Alabama.
Yeah, I mean, this is she's seen it, and that is a response, you know, common to African Americans in the South. They're not reflexively for gun control by any means, at least in polls I've seen, and precisely for this reason, that the shotgun has been an equalizer in a situation of juridical neglect and worse, in a situation of terrorism. It's the only people had to defend themselves, and her father and other men in the neighborhood kept that neighborhood safe, although apparently there was a kind of car bombing there or some sort of incident. But that's quite a lesson to have in your life.
And Judith Kipper, here we see Condoleezza Rice reaching out across party lines and making a convert, at least on one issue, out of Jeff. She's been relatively low profile in this administration recently. Do you see a potential political future for Condoleezza Rice one day? Does she have that sort of character?
She certainly has the character and the potential. And as I said earlier, this is somebody who's going to succeed at whatever she tries to do. To do in her life. I suspect that she's more inclined to go the academic route, to head an institution, to be a university president, to write books, to lecture and so on, because she does have an academic background, and I would think she would go in that direction. Mm. But if she wanted to run for office, I have no doubt that she would campaign very well. She's very warm and reaches out to people, touches people's hearts, not only with her own story, but with her. She's a very nice person. You feel it when you see her. And she could certainly present herself well in any political campaign.
We're joined now by Dr. Arnold Kanter. He's former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, 1991 to 93, former Special Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs, and worked with Condoleezza Rice under the first President Bush, George H.W. Bush. Good evening and welcome, Arnold Kanter.
Hello.
Thanks for being with us. Give us a sense, in this war cabinet, Condoleezza Rice is the only woman and the youngest member of that team. She's there to adjudicate and to keep things on an even keel and moving forward. How do you think she handles these big egos, these big personalities, these men not accustomed necessarily to bowing to a younger woman or giving her the last word with the president?
In a word, masterfully. First of all, Condi has worked with big egos in her role as a provost at Stanford University.
Mm-hmm.
There are no egos like academic egos, and so she's she certainly had good training at Stanford, but also by her style, by her personality, she would have and does have no problem in doing her job as National Security Advisor, coordinating and managing the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, and so on.
We hear a lot about how a key part of her role is distilling the issues for the president. Of course, any National Security Advisor would do that for any president. But is there... Do you have any concern that the issues get too distilled, too simplified somehow in the Condi-Rice boil-down, that nuance may get boiled out? Witness, for example, Axis of Evil.
Well, we can have an interesting discussion about Axis of Evil, but I'm not concerned. First of all, I don't think that's an illustration of things getting boiled down.
Okay.
It may be a good illustration of an excess of speechwriter's rhetoric. But not of boiling the nuance out of the substance. No, I'm not concerned at all about Condi's ability to convey clearly and straightforwardly complex ideas without oversimplifying them or making them into caricatures. Quite the contrary.
And knowing her as you do, how do you see the imprint of her view of the world on America's response to September 11th?
Well, of course, as National Security Advisor, her job is not to have an imprint. And so any imprint we might see is perhaps more in the eyes of us as beholders than her as author. But I think Condi is very clear-eyed, very hard-nosed, very realistic, and is very tough-minded. I mean, you can't have studied the Soviets, particularly the Soviet military, for as long as she did and be anything other than tough-minded.
Hmm. And how, her education was in the Cold War Soviet Union. How do you think that area of expertise plays out in this conflict?
Well, I'm not sure how much it plays out. I mean, Condi has a good knowledge of military affairs and military operations. That, of course, is very helpful.
Hmm.
And she is good at separating military operational questions from broader political and policy questions, and it seems to me that is an invaluable skill.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, I'm not sure how much her academic background and her specialty in Soviet military affairs really plays in the current conflict.
How about her upbringing in the violently segregated South in terms of establishing attitudes that may play out in her advice to the president?
It appears that Condi and the president just have a relationship of complete mutual trust and confidence, and that's what's key in an effective and successful national security advisor. And how much her background has prepared her to be the person she is and whom the president can repose that complete trust and confidence, who can say?
Arnold Kanter was a former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, 1991 to 93. Arnold Kanter, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
We're talking about President George W. Bush's National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice. What do you think? What is the Condi Rice view of the world? And did you think you'd live to see the day when a president's National Security Advisor was young, black, female, and tough as a razor strap? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about President George W. Bush's National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice. She's young, black, female, tough as nails, and in a recent Vogue magazine, elegant as you want to be at the same time. What's her imprint? What's her impact on the dramatic foreign policy world that George Bush is facing right now? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined by Judith Kipper. She's director of the Middle East Forum at the Council on Foreign Relations, and by Christine on the line. Welcome, Christine. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm really happy that you're having this discussion about Condoleezza Rice, and I'm very proud to see a black woman as National Security Advisor.
Christine, is it something that comes as a surprise to you? Is it mold breaking for you? It certainly looks that way.
I don't think it comes. It doesn't really come as a surprise for mm-hmm. me, simply because I believe that overall, in the long run, achievement and intelligence and being focused, that surpasses race.
When you look at Condoleezza Rice, what do you see?
I see a very focused, intelligent woman who cares about her job, cares about the people, cares about the president that she works for. And although I don't agree with all her policies, but I just appreciate the fact that she seems so committed to what she's doing.
Do you think there's a special element that she might bring to the job as a woman, as a black woman?
Oh, definitely, definitely.
What?
I think that before, I mean, for instance, I mean, if you ask me who was the last national security advisor, I wouldn't be able to name it. You know what I mean?
But you know this one.
But I know this one, and I think that more people who weren't very interested in politics and government, especially, you know, after what happened during the last election, mm-hmm. you know, they're taking a closer look, and especially since her role as National Security Advisor, it's so important with, you know, since 9/11.
Christine, thanks so much for your call. It's great to have you. Lee's on the line from Buffalo, New York. Lee, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'm a long-haul truck driver, and I'm still a liberal, and I still believe in gun control.
No matter what Condi Rice says.
No matter what Condi Rice says. But look, you know, I still remember that speech at the Republican convention. And my
sure.
first thoughts were that, you know, I was watching her, and I said, you know, now this is a very ambitious woman who really knows how to work that crowd.
Are you glad to have her watching out for the security of the United States?
Well, you know, the problem I thought, you know, when the Bush administration first came on board, and when she was with her father's administration, Bush's father's administration,
mm-hmm.
I thought, you know, she was too much of a stereotypical cold warrior.
Mm-hmm.
You
and,
know, that,
and
you know,
now.
Prior to September 11th, I still thought she still pursued that point of view.
And today.
And today, I'm still very skeptical of this whole 9/11 thing, and I'm not quite sure if they really know what they're doing.
Lee, thanks very much for your call. Judith Kipper, we've just got a minute left, but we've had Jack Beatty say he sort of hopes that Condi Rice brings her containment, the containment lessons of the Soviet era, to this new world. Evan Thomas says this administration is more interested in regime change. That's bold and not exactly containment. In a word or a phrase, which way do you see Condi Rice leaning?
Well, I myself hope for containment, and I think that it's a whole new world out there after September 11th, and everything she may have learned being a Soviet military expert has been tempered by her experience now as National Security Advisor and the fact that the threats that the United States and the rest of the world face cannot be dealt with through traditional military means, and she's smart enough to know the difference.
Judith Kipper is director of the Middle East Forum at the Council on Foreign Relations. Judith Kipper, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, on balance, what do you see here, containment or regime change? Those are powerful words.
They are. We just have to hope that the arguments for both sides are being waived much more carefully than that loose phrase, axis of evil, would indicate. One point, her father, John Rice, died of cancer in December 2000, but not before he had learned that his daughter had been made the National Security Advisor.
That's a long way from down the street from the 16th Street Church blowing up in Birmingham, Alabama.
Wow. It sure is.
Jack, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, for ongoing coverage of the day's events, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Tomorrow, the 2002 Winter Olympics begin in Salt Lake City. That means 17 days of all-out skating, skiing, and sliding. If figure skating fatigue, luge languor, or ice hockey ennui start to set in, you may want to get some perspective with a good old Olympics film festival. To set the mood, we're joined by our on-point celluloid champion, Garen Daly, to talk about the Olympics in the movies. Welcome, Garen Daly.
Hey, good evening. How are you doing, Tom?
We're well. Thanks for being with us, Garen. Garen, talk to us about Hollywood's view of the Olympics. What are the big themes of Olympics movies?
Well, the first and foremost theme is always inspiration. And to start from the top, we really should go with the only film that's won an Academy Award for Best Picture, and that is Chariots of Fire.
That is the only Olympic-related film.
Olympic-related.
Here we go.
We are here today to give thanks for the life of Harold Abrahams, to honor the legend. Now there are just two of us, young Aubrey Montague and myself, who can close our eyes and remember those few young men with hope in our hearts and wings on our heels.
Daily, the Olympics makes heroes. It takes young men, young women, men in this case, out of obscurity and pulls them up to this pedestal at the very top of the world. Where was the inspiration in Chariots of Fire going? What was it directed toward?
I think it was directed to showing the kind of dichotomy that is created within the Olympics. On one side, you have this character, Eric Liddell, this Scottish guy who is incredibly, intensely religious, who is giving his body to God. On the other side, you have this guy named Harold Abrams, who is, again, a gifted athlete, but he is more interested in self. So the dichotomy of individualism versus this kind of glorification, inspirational story kind of bounces back and forth. And you see it later on in the film as well when you start seeing the big guys, the people who are concerned about what's going on, trying to put pressure on the individual athletes, even though both of these athletes are amateurs. There's nothing about money in here, and I think that the fact that it takes place in 1924 gives us a chance to look with a long nostalgic eye towards those simpler kind of times.
But at the very pinnacle of sport, this does capture the sort of question that's there. Is this about the human as a worshipful sort of symbolic sacrifice to God at the peak of their performance, or is it more a humanistic kind of Renaissance view of making the very most of the athlete's body, maximizing the individual human potential, not as a hymn to God, but as an expression of humanity?
Well, yes, but the other problem that comes along down the line with this is that expression sometimes gets twisted and warped and gets the ego explodes in this thing because you're pushing yourself so hard, you have to believe in yourself so much
right.
that the ego becomes enormous. And in 1968, Robert Redford and Gene Hackman were in a wonderful film called Downhill Racer, where they kind of like at the cusp of when the team concept was really more powerful, but there was a new thing coming in, and that was the hot dogger.
There's a whole world out there that you know nothing about. You can't understand that, can you?
Well, what's there to understand? I'm here because I ski, and I ski fast. That's all there is to it.
That's it, huh? Yeah, you ski fast. You race. But you're reckless. You rack up a lot. No consistency. That's what Creech has.
It doesn't win a medal.
It counts for a lot. It comes from a certain consideration for the sport. A desire to learn. That's something you never had.
Gene Hackman talking to Robert Redford in Downhill Racer, and he's trying to say to the young man, there's more than simple speed. There's consideration of the sport. Isn't this really right at the heart of the whole tension around the Olympics? Is it just speed, or is there something more noble going on here?
Well, you know, it is a lot about speed, and I sometimes think that in Downhill Racer, what we're really looking at is some sort of allegory about a man's downhill slide done on a moral level, getting into his total ego, totally himself. And what's interesting about this film is at the end, Robert Redford has become this very, very fast skier. He has won a medal, but there's somebody coming up who is trying to push the envelope even farther. So in one way, there's this egotism going on, but another thing is we are achieving something really noble with these athletes.
Also something there about moving from a more gracious age to an age where the individual was everything, the kind of star era of athleticism, when the media got really clicked into this and people were becoming stars. It wasn't about consideration for the sport exactly.
That's right, that's right. And then occasionally you would get an athlete coming along, and there actually two films came out in the 70s and 80s about Steve Prefontaine, this totally driven runner from Oregon who wasn't all that talented, but what he was driven, and he was driven hard. Now, in Without Limits, which was produced by Tom Cruise, a wonderful film, kind of a cult status, Prefontaine is at the Munich 1978 Olympics, where the Israelis were killed by the Palestinian terrorists. Donald Sutherland plays the coach and addresses the team right afterwards.
This killing of Israeli athletes is an act of war. And if there's one place that war doesn't belong, it's here. For 1,200 years, from 776 BC to 393 AD, your fellow Olympians laid down their arms to take part in these games. They understood there was more honor in outrunning a man and killing him. I hope the competition will resume. And if it does, you must not think that running or throwing or jumping is frivolous.
Looking back on the Munich Olympics, where terror came into the Olympics, of course, the Olympics this year will be held where terror is the envelope, and the Olympics are trying to be held harmless against the surround of terror there. What was Steve Prefontaine's response athletically to the trauma of that Olympics in the movie story?
In the movie story and in life, mm-hmm. He ran a really good race, but he lost. He gave everything he had because, again, he wasn't all that talented, but what he was driven. But, you know, one of the things about that speech and what that movie hearkens us to is to talk about how the Olympics are political basketballs.
Mm-hmm.
And a great documentary that I would recommend to everybody is One Day in September, which chronicles what happened in Munich. And another one to kind of look at it in another way is Leni Riefenstahl's The Olympic.
This is the Nazi era film.
1936 documentary where she shows the techniques of how you glorify something, in this case something as repugnant as Nazism.
Well, it's all about putting laurels on human beings, on ourselves really, as with the athletes as stand-ins in a way, glorifying the best in human performance, at least athletically.
You know, and occasionally something comes along in the Olympics, and it seems to be almost every Olympics, there's a story out there, and you'll see this with the TV, they'll try and dig up these stories, but every once in a while there's something that's so true and so wonderful, and it happened at Calgary, the Jamaican bobsled team, and they made a movie out of it, and it's called Cool Runnings. And this is all about this Jamaican bobsled team never saw snow, but they managed to get into the Olympics, and they were misfits, they were outcasts, and no one liked them.
A little antidote to the it's all me ego approach.
That's right.
Just shut up, Sanka. Now, maybe you haven't noticed, but we aren't exactly winning any popularity contests here. They hate me. They hate you. They hate us. Now, we're even going to think about qualifying. We're each going to have to sit down and take a nice deep look inside. I didn't come all this way to get my butt whipped. As a matter of fact, now that I'm here, I thought I'd do a little whipping of my own. Good night, gentlemen.
Rise and shine.
It's butt whipping time.
The original Jamaican bobsledding team goes into action in Cool Runnings and lets us all chill out about this Olympian experience a little bit.
Yeah, that was John Candy in one of his more warm performances, being the coach of these guys. And that's a cathartic moment for them because at that point they become a team. Mm-hmm. And they realize no matter what anyone else says about them, no matter that they're underdogs, no matter that they're not respected, they are going to go out there and they're going to try and do their best and they're going to be true to themselves. That's a more inspiring film, to bring it back to where we should be, and that the Olympics are something that we should look at, the great endeavors that these athletes go and how they can inspire us.
And yet, at the same time, whenever we reach for greatness, there's always that danger of somehow going too far or going awry.
I'd rather go too far.
You are our Hollywood Olympian. Garen Daly, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Garen Daly is a film analyst and reviewer, owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and our On Point movie maven. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Jim Moses, Tim Skog, Michael Garth, and Isabella Tabarovsky. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're On Point.